Good morning. Welcome to the 2009-2010 season of the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this morning is to my right, Justice Ann Gardner, to my left, Justice Sue Walker. I'm Leanne Dofino. You are the very first case to argue this year. So if we haven't forgotten how to do it, we're ready to hear you argue. All right.
May it please the court. I'm Mike Windsor, and I represent Dr. Susan Mandel, who was involved in a divorce with Dr. Lance Mandel. Whether you look at this in the big picture or whether you look at it in the little technical picture, Dr. Susan Mandel ought to get this case reversed and remanded, and Dr. Lance Mandel's arguments ought to fail. What we've got here is essentially law that this court decided in Keith versus Keith years ago, that the court even reiterated a bit by citing Justice Annette Stewart's concurrence in the Finn case. And over, courts that have addressed this stockholders issue, whether it's this state or other states, have said that the stockholders agreement in a closely held corporation doesn't necessarily set the value of the shares. It can be a factor to be considered, but it is not the be-all and end-all. As one of the courts, I believe one of the Georgia Court of Appeals or Supreme Court put it, there's just too much opportunity for mischief when you allow people in a closely held corporation to arbitrarily set the value of their stock for whatever purpose it is. So in the big justice scheme of things, Lance's argument just doesn't work. This is a medical practice that he got involved with. He paid $11,000, 50 cents a share, for 22,000 shares of his medical practice. You know, there's no evidence on it, but I can't fathom that Dr. Lance Mandel or his counsel would get up here and say, well, if this medical practice were sold to a third party, he would somehow be restricted to receiving $11,000. And I'm not buying that. I mean, this court shouldn't buy it either. It just doesn't make sense. But what he wants to do is say that that is the value that his wife is stuck with when they get divorced, without any other evidence, without any other consideration. As a summary judgment issue, that's all that we're going to talk about. And his theory is, well, if I had to leave the medical practice, that's what I would have to resell the shares at. And the issue has been looked at over and over by courts, and that's been rejected over and over by court, by Texas courts, other states' courts. There's just not a lot of acceptance of this notion, and it can be especially prone to mischief when you have a case like this, where documents aren't signed in a timely manner, where all of a sudden, once the divorce pops up, we start having, oh, well, the shareholders agreement this and the shareholders agreement that, or let's enter into a new shareholders agreement. I mean, that's even conceivable, that this can all just pop up after the fact and try and hold the spouse to some number that these people, the members of the business, just arbitrarily assign. And there's, you know, I can't fathom a situation where they wouldn't all be on the same side of things. So in a big justice sense, did Dr. Susan Mandel get her shot at proving the value of Lance's medical practice? She did not. Judge Harris, as a summary judgment issue, just accepted that the shareholders agreement set the value. That was that. The value of the medical practice is $11,000, and we're not going to hear any more about it.
What about Appley's argument, estoppel argument?
Estoppel in the sense that she's accepted the benefits of the divorce, that argument?
By entering into a settlement.
Well, the settlement agreement, the settlement agreement didn't affect Dr. Lance and Dr. Susan vis-a-vis one another. I mean, what the settlement agreement did is return things to the status quo. It's Susan's position, and it was in her pleadings. We didn't address this because they resolved it. But it was Susan's position during the divorce that once she subpoenaed members of the medical practice, other members of the medical practice to produce documents, they notified Lance that he had not paid all, or he didn't get the shareholders agreement signed. He'd paid him the money. That's what the deal was. He paid him the money, but they didn't issue a stock certificate, and they were waiting on the shareholders agreement. Well, they waited 40-some-odd months, 44, close to 4 years before anybody bothered to do anything about it. So obviously it was a real concern to them. But as soon as they realized that Dr. Lance was in the middle of a divorce, they decided at that point, well, you know what? You didn't sign the shareholders agreement like you were required to do. You signed the stock purchase agreement. You bought the shares. You paid us the money. We accepted the money. But you didn't sign the shareholders agreement. So what we want to do is just set the whole thing aside. And Dr. Lance, who, you know, was probably more than happy to have the help from his business partners, said, sure, I'll tell you what, you give me back the $11,000 and we'll just call the whole thing off after 40-some-odd months. Well, Susan Mandel sued the medical practice and various members, and the way they ultimately settled the issue, that issue, was to undo that transaction that they had done, which we believe was nothing more than an attempt to defraud her of her interest in marital property. So the medical practice said, fine, tell you what, give us back the $11,000 that we had already given back to you. So now this $11,000 has changed hands three times. Lance paid it to them. They held on to it for 30-some-odd months. He paid them late, but he still paid them. They held on to the money. Then they gave the money back to the estate. Judge Harris said, fine, pay the money out of the community funds and give it back to them. So now the medical practice has the $11,000 they're supposed to have. They actually got around to issuing the stock certificate. So all the settlement with the third parties did was just restore the status quo before they started this shenanigans of trying to pretend like Lance hadn't fulfilled his obligations and was out of the medical partnership. So I think the estoppel argument, Lance was not harmed by it. I mean, I guess in the sense that what he was trying, I think he was trying to do failed, he was harmed. But the status at the beginning of the divorce was the community estate owned $11,000 or $11,000 worth of shares in Lance's medical practice. The status at the trial of the divorce was they still owned those same $11,000 worth of shares, 22,000 shares. Nothing had actually changed by the settlement agreement. So I don't think the settlement agreement, there was no settlement part that established the value of anything. All it did was just restore things to the way they were before we contend the third parties and Lance got together to manufacture trouble. On a technical level, the big picture is Lance's argument ought to fail. Whether it's Lance Mandel or anybody else in a closely held business in a divorce situation, the thing just, it's just mischief incarnate. It just is trouble with these closely held agreements where you have a really small deal. And one of the triggering factors a lot of times in these agreements is, of course, divorce. So if I get divorced, my spouse gets an arbitrarily low amount. That's what I'm hoping for anyway when I do one of these, in part. I mean, otherwise, why include divorce in it? Why not just include if I get out of the business entity, we put it all back? So in the big picture, it ought to fail. But in the technical picture, Lance has problems here too. First of all, he didn't sign the shareholders agreement. The other members of the business may have wanted him to. They may have felt he was obligated to, but he never actually signed the shareholders agreement. He had 40-something months to get it done, and it never got done. So nobody was relying on Lance's representations in the shareholders agreement. The one reference in the stock purchase agreement is that Lance will execute a shareholders agreement. But he didn't, and nobody forced the issue. Dr. Susan Mandel did not sign it either. So she's not contractually bound. Maybe if she had signed it, the situation might be different. I think in the big justice picture, that still stinks when you compel your spouse to sign this type of document. But in this case, we don't have to get there because Dr. Susan didn't sign it. Dr. Lance didn't sign the shareholders agreement either. But even if they had, if you read the shareholders agreement closely, which the cases say, you ought to look at these documents technically. These documents, first of all, the shareholders agreement doesn't set value. It does not establish the value of the medical practice. It establishes a purchase, or if you will, a repurchase price, so that if Lance does not get the shares, his wife, I guess had both of them bothered to sign the agreement, would have to sell the shares for $11,000. Or if he died, there are $11,000 essentially repurchase price or purchase price. It doesn't say anything about value on divorce. In this divorce case, Lance got the shares. So the triggering event never occurred. The way it's supposed to be valued, the shareholders agreement doesn't say anything about value. It's just about purchase agreement. And remember, this is a summary judgment instance here. And Judge Harris cut this off immediately. Everything that was offered through Brian Rice and the other witnesses was offered as an offer of proof. And Brian Rice details how he's qualified to make these business valuations, how he went through it. There's some consideration that he didn't put a specific value on the existence of the shareholders agreement. But his testimony, once you read it, he obviously considered it. He even talks about it at one point. But no, he did not sign a specific value to it. Instead, he gave a 15% discount for Lance's lack of control. Part of that lack of control would be through the shareholders agreement, obviously. But there was compelling evidence that should have been heard by a trier of fact in this case, rather than get cut off at summary judgment. I mean, you know, if Lance's attorneys had wanted to come in and argue that Brian Rice's numbers were not correct, that he should have considered other factors, that he didn't give enough weight to this or that, you know, that's certainly something that they got to do, and that probably goes to the weight of his testimony. But it doesn't go to whether as a threshold his testimony meets the criteria for being valid valuation testimony. I mean, that was another one of Lance's arguments, is that Brian Rice's testimony was so flawed it just shouldn't. We can't even think about reversing because there was no good evidence. Brian Rice offered a lot of testimony about how this business was set up, what its receivables was. He actually goes through three valuation methods when he discusses this, and he talks about why each of them are better or worse than the others. So to say that evidence didn't get you anywhere is just doesn't make sense.
I have a question that would change the subject just a little bit, but it goes back to one of the technical arguments, perhaps. What is your response to the Apley's argument that we can't determine if there was an unjust division of the property because we don't have any of the other values?
I have two responses to it. I mean, you know, my overarching feeling on the whole thing is that the appellee raises a lot of technical arguments to try and really not get to the heart of this, and that's one of them. But I think the values in this case, if you compare the evidence that was offered, and Lance and Susan both offered their inventories into evidence in this case, and I cited wherever it was, the numbers are not far apart. They're basically in agreement over what their marital estate consists of and what are the values. They're fairly consistent throughout. The only difference of any magnitude at all is the value of Lance's medical practice. Lance says his medical practice is worth $11,000. Susan's number, I believe, off the top of my head, was $1,110,000 or somewhere in that ballpark. That's the only real difference. So as far as any court findings of fact over the value of things, I don't think the court needs to make findings of fact over issues that aren't in dispute. And these people really didn't dispute the value of anything other than the medical practice, and that value was established as a matter of summary judgment. So, you know, there was no real fact issue there because it had been summary judgmented out, and Judge Harris even addressed the value of the medical practice in his findings of fact. There's just no real dispute. My other response to that is if a value or if an asset is so misvalued, or if it's mischaracterized even, that it's on its face just wrong, I don't think the courts need to come up with any other values. We don't need to say, well, in the big scheme of things, this was wrong. Obviously, the medical practice, the dispute between the parties, was significant. And if the court determines that that medical practice was significantly either undervalued or that Susan didn't get the chance to value, to offer evidence as to its value, and it's a significant asset. And I believe I cited a case, I can't think of it off the top of my head in there, it was a Dallas case that talked about if it's a big enough problem, we don't need to go through findings over every asset. We can just say, yes, the misvalue or mischaracterization of this asset obviously caused a problem.
Are there any other questions?
I'll reserve any other time I have.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good morning.
Good morning.
I think it is actually helps Dr. Lance's argument if we look at the big picture and then shortly look at the technical issues as they've been described. Lance cut a check for $11,000 for his practice. The practice kicked back a check, refunding it for $11,000. Then Susan wants this deal to go forward, so they kick another check in there for $11,000, and the practice gives a certificate to the practice. We have a variety of transactions there, all of which value themselves at the very transaction. Paid for consideration was $11,000 all through this divorce. So the only shenanigans, quote, shenanigans, that were going on were to try to inflate the value of the practice.
Now, Mr. Michelle, is there a serious argument to be made that the practice was actually worth only $11,000 for his interest?
Absolutely, and there's a very good reason for that. This is a residual of one of those areas where a lot of those businesses came in and took over as doctors' practices. That's why we have this structure. I thought I pointed this out pretty clearly in the brief, but I'm going to go over it again. The value is not in the practice at all. It is basically just an operating company. There's no value to it. It's the matrix. It's the level up that has the value. Matrix is where the profits go. Matrix is where the building ownership is going. It's the next level up. And I went through pretty good detail. Lance declined that offer to invest in that because that was where the value was. The value went in. He had to buy in and it had the risk. It was the business. It was the profit and loss. It was the risky venture. The second tier level was simply the operating company that allowed to send out bills, did the employee payments and check. Lance was an employee. He got a paycheck. He was a doctor who got a paycheck.
Well, to go back to, and I haven't read the expert testimony yet, but the Jesbray case, for example, wasn't there some commercial goodwill of the firm, of the group involved there that would have some value?
There can be. There certainly can be, but not in this structure. And Mr. Windsor is exactly right. You got to look at the particulars of each case. In this case, the goodwill of the practice is not in the practice. It is a residual of an of a of a corporate takeover that then goes away, if you're familiar with that practice in the late 90s and the early 2000s. That's what doctors' practices were doing. But in this case, with regard to the specific structure of this case, there would be no essentially goodwill of the practice if Lance leaves the practice, if Dr. Lance leaves the practice. And that was the issue that we heard somewhat in trial and it was argued back and forth. The commercial goodwill is not left with a departing shareholder or the value of the shares that were owned. And I think we have some pretty good evidence of that with the two doctors who did leave the practice. They got their $11,000 back. They were there for 13 years, Justice Gardner. You would think if there's any commercial goodwill or value there, they would be entitled to some compensation to that effect.
Okay, and, well, let me ask you this. Dr. Mandel didn't leave the practice. He didn't die. There was no involuntary transfer. You said in your brief that that the divorce somehow triggered the shareholders' agreement's limitation of $11,000. How exactly was it triggered?
Well, we believe the language of the stock restrictions says that upon divorce, under, I believe it's 4.02 of the stock purchase agreement, says the triggering event that a person can only sell them in accordance with the shareholders' agreement. And the only way to harmonize and give effect to both the provisions is to read that, is to read them together. At per se, we read that as a triggering event as the divorce action.
Okay, I'm looking at Section 4 of the shareholders' agreement.
Yes.
Where it says if the marital relationship, and the only provision for divorce I can find is where it says if the marital relationship of a shareholder is terminated by divorce and such divorced shareholders does not succeed to his former spouse's community interest, if any, his shares shall or may be. Well, an option kicks in and so forth and so on.
Correct.
But that, is that the event that?
Yeah, I think we use that provision as a, I don't know if there's a it's not a triggering event that he's got to sell them, but it, what it does is it puts a stock restriction on them.
Well, I think that's what some of the cases say that, well, the San Antonio Court under this exact language has said that this provision was not triggered by divorce. When the divorce shareholder did get all of the shares in the divorce.
Correct. I think that's right. I think if you look at the stock restrictions, and that's what this is, and it talks about the events of the divorce, even under the San Antonio case, if you look at that, or if you look under the Finn case, that when you have these stock purchase agreements, there may not have been a per se forced sale of the events, but the issue is he got the shares of stock, and you look to the stock restrictions that if he was going to try to transfer them, the best way and the conventional way to value shares of stock is if you look at how you what you can get on an open market on a willing buyer and a willing seller.
Okay.
This situation, he can't ever get more than $11,000 for them.
He can't, but if there's if they're valued as if the shares are valued as if the practice is an ongoing business, it would be.
Justice Gardner, this goes back to your original question. I think you've really got to focus the two. He was an employee. He gets his paycheck. He is a practicing. Don't mix the value he gets as a practicing physician, which is substantial, as well as Mrs. Mandel. They're both. You don't value what you make as just like an attorney. If you go out and work, you can perhaps maybe value a partnership and a large partnership if they've got some type of assets or something of that nature. Even the law firm analogy doesn't work in this case because we have the buffering zone between the association and Matrix, which was the holding company where the value went. You can include the value of Dr. Mandel's services. That's personal goodwill. That's his personal efforts. Those are all the things that go into the value of the company. Justice Gardner, we don't have any better evidence. Susan Mandel herself consummated the transaction for $11,000. However you want to look at it, whether Lance purchased in for $11,000, but at trial, she paid $11,000. That is a willing buyer and a willing seller. You have no better evidence than the actions of Susan Mandel herself in valuing exactly what she thought it was worth. She paid $11,000. I mean, aside from that's why I pull back on the big pictures. No matter how you want to look at this, if you want to look at the best reality, not litigation posturing or anything of that nature, what was paid and what was given? You got $11,000 for the shares of stocks, either at the conclusion of the summary judgment hearing or on the opening day of trial. I can't remember what it was.
What is the answer to your argument that that's price, not value?
That is value. That's the definition of value. If I go out and buy a house on the market, a willing buyer and a willing seller.
The whole point of this is it's not an open market. It's a predetermined price and not an open market, not any willing buyer, but a specific predetermined buyer at a specific predetermined price without any allowance for inflation, for deflation, for anything.
The appellant can't have it both ways, Justice.
He
said you got to look at the documents. You can only buy the asset.
Excuse me.
Okay.
If you're talking about a willing buyer on the open market, that is not what we have. And I see that you're confusing the two. It's either a willing buyer or a predetermined buyer. It's either what a person is willing to pay or a predetermined price, but it's not both.
Let me pull back. Let me.
Okay.
Let me say this. You have to take the asset with whatever conditions it has, as is. If there's a restriction, let's say you go out and buy a building that has deed restrictions in it that say it can't be developed commercially, although it's in a nice area where you'd like to put a nice law practice, but it's residential, deed restrictions are that you cannot give it its full commercial value, that it may be a lot worth a lot more. It's close to downtown, could have a lot more value out there. But because of these deed restrictions, it's going to reduce its value. It's the same thing with these cases. In any of these cases, and I've been on the business side of these transactions where you've got closely held corporations, that you have to take the asset with the documentation and the restrictions. That's what Finn talked about. You can't put the blinders on, although I think even if you took the blinders off in this case, we've got this. That's why I say the factors help us, because in this case you've got matrix up there and you've got the practice on a below that's really just an operating company that just cuts the checks, and you have the staff that collects fees and pays them out. But you can't excise the bad part of it or the good part of it from the value part of it. The stock restrictions go with the stocks. You can't separate them and pretend, oh, what is this really worth if I could go out on the open market? Just like this deed with a restriction on it, what would this property be if I could make it commercial? You have to take the good with the two. They're locked together. Those shares are restricted. And that then dovetails exactly into the market value. It narrows your market, no doubt about it. I can't go in and buy it. I'm not a doctor. And that affects the market. They are stuck with the good and the bad of those documentations. That's exactly what Mr. Windsor said on the opening, is you've got to look at the details and you've got to take the good with bad. And we put it in our brief that exactly, we made this point in our brief several points times. We made the same point in front of Judge Harris. You can't take the good with the bad. She wants to pretend that, oh, I want to ignore the restriction, say it's worth all this money, and let's go forward. And then say, then all of a sudden, oh, we got this deed restriction on here. I'm sorry, a stock restriction. And that dovetails into, I want to respond to Mr. Windsor's argument about Brian Rice's testimony. It's analogous to a case I tried in Dallas in which we lost half of it to a jury on a business valuation. The judge then granted a J&OV, and it was affirmed by the Dallas Court of Appeals in Mood versus Kronos. Very similar to Brian Rice's. Now, I know we play some semantics about whether he said he considered it or didn't consider it. I guess he said, I considered it because I know it was there. But he didn't say he put any type of value to it. In the Kronos case, it was a very similar case in Mood. They're looking at a variety of different sales in different territories and with different products. They had two subparts to it. He had a distributorship agreement of where, and once again, you got to look at the contract to determine the value and the damages. The contract said, no, you don't get all of the territories. You only get three of the territories, and you don't get all of the products. You only get one product. The expert didn't do that. He just looked at all of the territories and all of the products, and the court said, that's not weight of the expert's testimony under the long line of Texas Supreme Court cases. That is just no evidence. If you are just going to wholesale not consider an aspect of the contract, that's no evidence. And that's what we think Brian Rice's testimony was, no evidence. No disrespect to Mr. Rice. He does an outstanding work. I think his job here clearly was to try to get the biggest number possible. With regard to this buy-sell agreement, if it's not a triggering event, you cannot excise the value of waiver from it. And I can't help but say we've got what I think are the documents, and then we got the actual conduct of the parties, and they merged together. We've got the 11,000 value. We have various transactions back and forth. Nobody came back. The practice never came back and said, you know what? I think this is really worth a lot more than $11,000. Let's just ignore that. You pay us. We think this practice is now, after you being here, Mr. Mandel, and you've got some commercial goodwill, Justice Gardner, we now think this practice is really worth $1 million. That's the true value of it. Pay us $1 million, and we'll give you your share certificates. That's the best way you can value the actual value of these shares, is by looking at the actual transaction. Nobody asked for $1 million. Lance Mandel would never pay $1 million for nothing. He makes his money by practicing medicine. We'd ask the court, affirm this case, allow the parties to get on with their life, and allow them to get on with their medical practice. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Sorry.
Mike.
If I may, I would like to amplify something that I heard Mr. Michel say during Justice Gardner's questions, and I keep skirting around this sometimes. Mr. Michel said there's no value to the practice, and he's talking about Matrix and the holding companies and how they work and that no value trickles down. He said there's no value of this in residuals. There's no goodwill if Dr. Lance leaves the practice. And then as an example, he talked about the building with the deed restrictions. And he said, you know, the value, and then he kind of waffled on what the value might be. My point is, that's all evidentiary issues. We didn't get that far in this case. We got summary judgmented out for $11,000. We never got to get into the debate and the evidence over what the value really is. We didn't get that far. We didn't make it that far. So all of those things Mr. Michel is saying about what value trickles down, what value is this, you know, there's really no value, that's all evidence, and we didn't get to there in this case. Mr. Michel said that at trial, Susan paid $11,000 for the shares. Well, that's true. She's undoing what was already done. I mean, to say that somehow Susan picked a fair value to give back is to let Lance profit from his own wrongdoing in this case. I think that was not anything like a fair market transaction. As Justice Dofino pointed out, it was a very restricted deal. You're going to give them back this shares, and you're going to give this money, and we're just going to put things the way they were. So I don't think that's even applicable. This was a doctor's deal, this whole medical practice. And anybody, I think, who's seen cases like this, now understand that there's a holding company for this, and the receivables go into this company, and the equipment's actually owned by this company, and the doctors get paid from this company, and somebody else owns the building and pays the staff. Lance wasn't paying $11,000 for some auto parts business in the middle of nowhere. He's paying $11,000 to get involved in a medical practice. And I guess there are two ways you can get involved in a professional practice. One of them is everybody pays a lot of money for their shares, fair value, and we renegotiate our shares every year, and money changes hands every year when we decide somebody's shares are worth more if we want to allocate the payment. The other way to do it is what they did in this medical practice. You buy in for a fairly low amount of money, then based upon whatever factors we deem, how much business you bring in, how successful you are, that sort of thing, then we allocate your income every year based on that. So the notion that it's just a wrongheaded notion to say that Lance was paying fair market value for these $11,000 when this is a closed deal and everybody knows how that's paid. The last thing I want to leave this court with is the testimony was there were four shareholders. Each of them paid $11,000 for their shares in this medical practice. If this medical practice sells for more than $44,000, where does the extra money go? Does Lance leave that on the table? It's nonsense. That's not even worth contemplating. That's the value that we're trying to get to. That's how this medical practice is valued, is if it sells to a third party, reasonable buyer, reasonable seller, what is the value that Lance takes away from it? And we never got the opportunity to offer that evidence and think what we should. Thank you.
Thank you. Your case is submitted. We appreciate your argument. Appreciate you being here today. Your argument's been very helpful. And you are now excused, and this court will be in recess.